Welcome to Between a Rock and a Hard Place. I'm Hannah.
And I'm Colleen, and we're here to tell you a little bit about life in Iraq.
Woohoo!
Today we're going to take a bit of a trip through Kurdistan.
A tour, if you will.
Indeed. We're going to be tourists, or tour guides, maybe?
Tour guides.
For all of the different places we've been, and some of the places that are really popular that maybe we haven't been, and some of the places that are really just gone to by Kurds, and some places that are really just gone to by foreigners who visit.
Yeah, tourism is kind of a, not necessarily a new concept in Kurdistan. It's still a little bit of a Wild West of a concept, I guess I would say.
Well, they definitely have two major groups of people who are coming. There are people from other parts of Iraq or the Middle East mm-hmm. who come. And then, you know, there's this desire to get more and more of Europeans or other Asians or Americans to
outsiders. And we do have to also qualify that for both of us, it's been quite a while since we've been to some of these places. So they may be different now.
Things change. That whole Wild West thing applies.
Yeah.
Even when you're talking about ruins that are thousands of years old.
It's true. I will say, though, for me, it always surprised me. Two things always surprised me about going significant places in Kurdistan. Mm-hmm. One, if you went somewhere ancient, you were allowed to, like, get up close and personal. Mm-hmm. Like, there are no barriers or guards or people standing there being like, please don't touch that.
Right.
Like, they're a little bit taken for granted, I guess.
I mean, there are a lot of them, so...
That's true.
That seems a little bit fair.
And the second one is that in my experience with, like, natural beauty, you know, in the U.S. we have tons of state and national parks. And so when we go see a waterfall, like, you can go up to it and, like, play around in it, but it's just a bunch of people playing around in nature. Where in my experience in Kurdistan, it's like, look at this beautiful waterfall with a restaurant that's built right next to it.
Yeah. And, like, all sorts of little boats and...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like,
or you could... Flags and paintings on the rocks and...
Right. Or you could pay to, like, go up to the waterfall and, like, get in it or... Yeah, it was just much more tourist trap-like.
Commercialized.
In a way that I'm not really used to. Like, Americans value wilderness as wilderness on some level.
Yeah, at least some.
And perhaps that's a more recent history for the U.S.
Maybe.
Than long-term. But, yeah, those are always the two things that I think about when I think of Kurdish tourist places, is, like, you can get up close and personal, but also sometimes it's very commercial and...
Not exactly the pleasant experience that we would hope for right. as an American, but that's not to say that our Kurdish friends didn't really love some of those places.
Yeah, they absolutely did. They absolutely did.
So where should we start? We have a long list of different things, some of which we will mention very briefly.
Yes. Yeah, we're definitely not going to get into all the details of each of these
places.
And if
you've been to Iraq and we miss your absolute favorite place, write to us and let us know.
Yeah, I think we should also say that some of the places we've been, we don't know the names of. Because, yeah. Again, Wild West, not everything is named.
Yeah, there was this one rock carving that we encountered up in the mountains with zero signage, zero, like... I could never find that again, probably ever,
mm-hmm.
because we went on a hike, and there it was.
Yeah. Yeah. So, it's always an adventure. Let's begin with Suli.
Suli is where I lived, and so there are a lot of places there that I think you have not been to.
Yeah. I have not been to much in the Suli area.
Did we never take you to the Amna Suraka, the Red House?
I have been to Suli, like, 3 times.
Okay.
And yeah, you weren't there for one of them.
I'm sorry. I would have taken you to the Amna Suraka.
I'm sure.
Maybe. Mm-hmm. It's an old military center for Saddam and, like, prison.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not exactly a pleasant place to go. They have it set up with kind of reenactments and, like, you can see people, like, in the position of being tortured. Not actual people, but, like,
mannequins.
It's kind of awful.
Well, now I'm not sad that I never went there.
But there is this one hallway that the entire walls are covered with mirrors, little tiny broken bits of mirror, mm-hmm. and the ceiling is covered with little tiny, like, fairy lights, like Christmas lights.
Ooh, sparkly.
And so it's magical walking in there, but the symbolism of it is also really heartbreaking, because it represents the villages and the number of people who were killed by Saddam during Anfal, during his genocide of the Kurds.
Yeah. Yikes.
So it's sad, but also really beautiful. Mm-hmm. And also, weirdly, a really difficult place to photograph.
Yeah, because how do you capture sparkly, sparkly, sparkly?
Yeah. Because there are no other lights in there besides those Christmas lights. And they're all reflecting off these tons and tons of little bits of broken mirror. Connected with that, and outside of Suli, not in Suli, but another place that is a place that a lot of people go as a tourist in memory of all of that genocidal and tragedy is Halabja. And there are some really big statues and a large graveyard, and it wasn't open because it had been partly burned down before we went on our trip to there. There's a museum that you can go and see there.
And Halabja is the city that had chemical warfare that really kind of kicked off Kurds getting help from outside in a lot of ways, like the pictures and videos from that. Really, really, really sad.
Yeah, and awful.
But sparked a lot of international outrage, as they ought to have.
Also in Suli, there's a Suleimani Archaeological Museum that a lot of people go to. It's free, and it's interesting, especially if you could go with someone who can read and translate the signs for you.
Oh, because they're all in Kurdish.
The first time I went, I was like, well, I can kind of read it, but I have no idea what it says, because that vocabulary is not really in my vocabulary.
Right, it would be specialized on some level.
Yeah. Also, outside of Suli, we did a lot of hiking, and there are some really beautiful places. There's a cave called Hazarmerd, which has this whole story about this woman with 1,000 husbands. And
that's too many husbands.
Yeah. I heard different versions of it, and none of them seemed to make a lot of sense to me, but, you know, you could ask a local person.
Did she go to the cave to get away from the husbands? Did the husbands lock her in the cave?
No, I got the impression that that's where she kept them.
Oh, all right, fair.
But again, there were multiple versions, and it's a fun thing you could ask someone about.
All right. Is it, a big
cave? It's a really big cave.
So she could fit 1,000 husbands in there.
Maybe that's why they said she had 1,000. It's a really big cave. Okay. Also out that direction is a place called Chemirezan, where there's an ancient carving, some Zoroastrian and Assyrian style carvings there. And it's a hole in the wall really high up in this cliff face, and there's a little staircase that goes up to it now. It's metal, it's been added. And also a lot of interesting stories regarding that one. Some people were like, oh, it's a tomb, and some people were like, oh, it's a bathtub, and some people were like, oh, it's a place where they would hide out and wait for, you know, approaching armies to see, you know, from, because you can see pretty far from there.
A lookout tower.
But yeah, I also don't know what that one really is for. Again, that whole sense of, like, these old things are just here, and no one's ever really taken the time to know what they were there for.
Right.
And no one really cares.
Yeah. Not a lot of archaeology. It's hard to do a lot of archaeology in a generally unstable region.
The other place that we often went, places that tourists go, are waterfalls. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about several waterfalls, I think, today. One of the ones that is very popular is the Ahmed Awa Waterfalls, and it's got these giant, not stairs, but like stairs. They're like
steps.
Steps for giants, really. Because they're like knee to hip height, and it's more of a climb than a walking upstairs.
Yeah.
Also, yeah, very crowded with people, a lot of trash, a lot of
Tomfoolery.
And, you know, a restaurant right next to it, and but also, like, a genuinely cool waterfall.
Yeah.
Sergaloo is another area that's, like, a tip-top, you know, picnic spot in the spring. Beautiful water kind of running down a mountainside. Not really waterfall, but, you know, little tiny waterfalls along the way. Also, just really full of trash and people.
Yeah.
We would drive through there every spring as we kind of took a little tour of the scenery when it's beautiful and green, and the kids would be out on the side of the roads near the villages selling bunches of Nergis flowers, little daffodils, and we would end up driving through Sergaloo, and it was...
It's also really fun to say.
It is.
Sergaloo.
It is. As we drive out of Sully towards Erbil, there are a couple other places that are really high traffic tourist areas. Rawanduz and Saran are really close. Rawanduz is a valley or canyon almost.
Mm-hmm.
It's really beautiful.
Yeah, it's like the Grand Canyon of Kurdistan.
Yeah. The top of it now has a like a resort and ski slopes and stuff up there, at least in the winter.
Is that like Coric Mountain?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Now that you say that, though, I may be confusing the two.
The two of them?
There's something at the top of the Rawanduz area. Sure. It may not be. You're right. Coric Mountain is where there's the ski slopes.
Yeah.
Which is also up that direction.
Mm-hmm.
I've never been there.
Yeah, me neither. Not big skiers.
Well, and it didn't really take off until after I left.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember someone taking me to Rawanduz, but not telling me that they were taking me to Rawanduz.
And it's a little out of the way.
Like coming around a corner and being like, holy cow! Like, huge, beautiful ravines with water at the bottom and like...
Greenery.
Not anything I expected to see.
Yeah.
So it was a nice surprise, but it was also a little bit like, you couldn't give me any warning. Like,
yeah.
Could have been like, we're going to go see this really cool thing. You were just like, doo 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 doo.
Road trip. The other big city, not big city, the other city that's on the way to Erbil that we've both been through that's a popular location is Shaklawa.
Ah, Shaklawa.
What do you remember of Shaklawa?
So Shaklawa, the first time I ever went on a Kurdish picnic, we went through Shaklawa. That was part of it. And it was definitely hyped to me as like this beautiful mountain town, and it's so lovely, and the weather is so nice, and you're really gonna love it. And we ended up just kind of like hanging out in the main shopping street.
Yeah.
And like, I mean, we wandered up and down the streets and ate nuts from different vendors and like, but I was just kind of like, this is not, I don't get it. I don't get why people love this.
Yeah.
And I went back to Shaklawa later to stay with some friends, and like, it is beautiful. Beautiful countryside. But I mean, I also grew up in Western North Carolina where everything is beautiful all the time. So my standards maybe are a little different.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember it getting talked about as, like, this really, like, stunningly beautiful place. And to me it didn't look that much different from most other small mountain towns.
Yeah. It is the place, though, that lots of people from the south have houses in Shaklawa.
Right.
So because it's cooler.
More of a resort town in some ways.
Yeah, like a vacation getaway kind of place, which I get.
I mean, it certainly is cooler than Baghdad.
Or Erbil, even.
Yeah, Erbil, I will say, is pretty stifling in the summer, especially.
It is.
So a little bit of mountains is nice.
Yeah, for sure.
Hey, this is Steve. My wife and I have been with Servant Group International for quite a while now, which means that we're sort of old, which also means that we need some fresh, new faces here at Servant Group. We'd love for you to join us.
In Erbil, though, there's also lots to do. I think we talked about this when we talked to Victoria about Erbil being one of the longest continuously inhabited cities.
Mm-hmm.
And that specifically is downtown, the Citadel, which is kind of at the center of the city.
It's up on a tell, so mm-hmm. It's a ancient mound of city, built on city for generations and generations.
Yeah. And that's one of the places where there has been a lot of archaeological things.
Mm-hmm.
My first year living in Erbil, the people renting the house next to us were Italian and French archaeologists who've been working at the Citadel.
Oh, cool.
Which was kind of neat. They were loud, but
they're Italian.
So there's a lot more signage up there, mm-hmm. telling you about what all the different things are and how old they are.
And there's kind of a neat little museum up there too, with mm-hmm. explanations in English and Kurdish.
Two museums up there now, because there's neat. Also a textile museum that's up there.
Okay. I think the textile one is actually the only one I've been to.
Oh, because there's a textile one and then there's like the archaeological one.
Yeah, I don't think the archaeological one was open when I was up there.
Yeah, so it's pretty cool, and they're working on restoring it, because it's in pretty much disrepair.
Yeah.
Even in the 10 years since I first moved there, they've really done a lot to make it beautiful. And then the Citadel kind of looks out over the main bazaar
mm-hmm.
there in Erbil, which still feels very old school. It still looks very ancient, and they built a big fountain and park on one side of it now, which is also very beautiful. And they're kind of trying to build like a new sparklier bazaar, but I don't know if that ever went through, because I feel like most of the Kurds are like, no, why would we do that when we have a perfectly functional, lovely, ancient bazaar right here?
Yeah, there is a little bit of that competition between the old and the new that I think mm-hmm. you find in almost every culture.
Yeah.
Some people want something flashy and new, and other people are like, but the old is good.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so that's probably the biggest touristy thing in Erbil. It's really easy to get to. There's also an old mosque out there. I went to a really cool photography exhibit in the old bathhouse at the top of the Citadel.
Huh.
It was weird, but very cool. Very nice. Artsy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, it was pretty cool. And that's the only time the bathhouse has ever been open for people to go in.
That's for this art exhibit.
So yeah. It was pretty awesome.
Yeah.
There's also a really big park in Erbil, Sami Abdul Rahma Park. It's several acres. And, I mean, it's a park. Green grass, trees, people wandering around. There's a train, the little trains that you can ride, like, in the zoo.
Yeah.
That drives around the park, and you can pay, like, I don't know, 1,000 dinar to ride around the park.
Ride around the park in the train.
And, I mean, the park is big enough to justify a train. So that's kind of fun, too. They do a big Nowruz stuff in the park.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there's not really there's a really big, beautiful mosque there.
Mm-hmm.
That I never went in, but if you drive past it, you know that it's the big, beautiful mosque.
Yeah, I've seen pictures, and I mean, I've probably driven past it, but
it's blue, mostly.
It's very blue.
And then near where I lived, in Erbil, there is a really, 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 really old mosque that they recently have been restoring.
Hmm.
I noticed that the last time I was in Erbil, it was just the tower, the minaret. but they've rebuilt the mosque next to it. And it's also really beautiful in a very modern sort of way.
Huh.
I don't know if it's touristy, but it definitely, like, people within Erbil are like, oh yeah, have you seen that mosque? It's really beautiful.
Ah, okay. You mentioned Nowruz as one of the things that is the parties in the park.
Mm-hmm.
The place that has the biggest parties is Acre, right?
Yeah, Acre. Yeah, so that's a city built into the side of the mountain. So.
And it's not far from Erbil. It's a couple hours, maybe?
An hour and a half.
Okay.
So a lot of the houses are actually, like, a house front, but the inside is, like, a cave.
Huh.
Again, I'm pretty sure that's to keep it cool in the summertime.
That is nice.
But then every year for Nowruz, they do, like, a fire walk where everyone in the town gets, or a lot of people in the town, have torches. And they walk up the side of the mountain to the very top and light a big bonfire and fireworks at the top. And all around the sides of the mountain, because it's pretty much sheer rock in most places, they have long Kurdish flag banners that they drape all along the sides of the mountain. So it's very spectacular.
There are videos. We'll have to link some in the show notes.
Yeah, I never actually got to be in Acre for Nowruz, but I kind of always wanted to because it looked... Because they do it at night, so it's like this line really of fire winding looking. Up. It's really cool.
I also have never been there in person, but I've seen videos.
The city itself is beautiful.
Mm-hmm. It's also the city that was the encampment of Alexander the Great. I think he theoretically founded it.
All right. He wasn't there when I was there.
Really?
No.
Oh, that's too bad.
Wasn't around.
That was the one place we never did actually find or get to go to. We decided it was maybe a little too close to Mosul, but like the battlefield of Gaugamela, where Alexander the Great defeated the Persian army or had a battle with the Persian army or something. Mm. I used to know more about that.
Yeah, there are definitely places that was like, I really wanted to go there, but we never could because it was never safe enough. Not that there's not plenty in the north to see.
This is true. Because we're only halfway through our list. From Acre, the next place over that I was thinking of is Ahmadiyya.
Mm-hmm. Or Ahmadi.
Or Ahmadi.
I think that's a Badini-Sorani difference, but I don't actually know.
I actually think it's a Kurdish-Arabic difference. Because on the maps and things, it's Ahmadiyya. But there, I always heard it called Ahmadi.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a lot of students who Ahmadi was their village. Like their family village. Yeah, in Dahuk.
It is beautiful.
It is really cool.
It's built on a high plateau.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but like the city is built all the way to the edges of the city, the plateau.
And it's kind of a plateau, like in the most classic sense. Like there are no other plateaus around it. There are some mountains. Like you can get up on a mountain and look down at Ahmadi.
But you can't get to it from there.
Right.
It's far enough away. It's surrounded by flat space.
Yeah. And it's cool when you're in the city, you can look out at down at the plains of Dahuk. Or between Ahmadi and Dahuk. It's really cool. But also a Roman city, right?
Right. And it's got an old Roman like road leading up to an old Roman gate that you can go see and that a lot of people go see. It's certainly not the road anyone uses to get in now. It's not in good enough repair, and it's also narrow, too narrow for cars.
Narrow and windy. I think there's also some biblical person's tomb up there. This was another one of those, like, someone said that to me after I had been there, but they couldn't tell me who it was.
Yeah.
And so I remember kind of seeing, like, a churchy, tomb-y-looking building, but, like, I don't know.
Man. Yeah.
But it is really, it's really popular for Kurds and Westerners to go up there.
Mm-hmm.
On the trip where we went to Ahmadi, I went with some American friends who are very explore-y. Katrina's husband, Kinley.
Yeah.
Kinley and Katrina, I should say, took us on this trip. And one of the places we went was Duin Castle.
Okay.
And there were actually two different places that we stopped, and I'm not sure which one is Tween Castle, if I'm being completely honest.
Okay.
Because it's kind of, it's off the main beaten path, and I don't think you could find it unless you knew where you were going specifically. So one of them was kind of up on a hill, and it's ruins of a castle, but there's still a tower standing. And then the other one is, as you come down off the mountain, there's kind of this, I guess it would be like a really small tell.
Mm-hmm.
It's more like a hill. Like, you can walk up it super easily.
Yeah.
But it also has the ruins of a castle on the top of it.
Huh.
And so I'm not sure which one is which.
Yeah.
But I think the lower one, the story was that it was kind of like, no one lived there as a castle. It was kind of like a lookout fortress. So if something was going down, everybody would flee there.
Okay.
But that there was some princess who was fleeing her father and locked herself into it, and it got knocked down, and that's why it was in ruins.
Oh, okay.
But it was another one of those places that, like, there are no signs, there are no, like, guardrails. And so we have pictures of us climbing just, like, all over this ruins of a castle. And it was really cool. Again, I couldn't tell you where it was or how we got there. But it was pretty awesome.
That does sound awesome. It reminds me, actually, of out in that same area, somewhere out on the way to Amity, we visited one of Saddam's old palaces that is also a ruins.
Of course.
Not necessarily just from time, but definitely from active destruction.
Yeah.
And, like, vandalism and, like, attack on this particular space. And,
sure.
I don't have very many photos of there because the walls were just covered with all sorts of profanity. It was an interesting place to see.
Yeah.
The demise of someone that, you know, was, like, I don't know, part of history that I was alive for.
Right, right. Not ancient
history. Contrast to the ancient history where, like, no one knows the stories of, like, these things and it's all vague. It's like, here, everybody knows. And
yeah. And they're still mad about it.
And they're still mad about it.
Yeah, for sure. Let's talk about some sacred-y places.
Okay. So, Lalish
mm-hmm.
is the center of Yazidi faith and area and culture.
We talk about Lalish a lot in the episodes about Yazidi faith.
Mm-hmm.
I have never been there, much to my regret.
It's really fascinating and beautiful. One of the distinctives I remember thinking was that they had a lot of trees on their streets. And, like, even in and around their temple, and obviously it was an area that was well cared for.
Mm-hmm.
And those distinctive towers with the ridges on them.
Yeah, they almost look like a citrus juicer,
yeah,
but pointy. Not rounded.
They're very distinctive and very, very beautiful.
Yeah, they are. They're very beautiful. A lot of history. We talk extensively about Lalish and that, mm-hmm. those episodes about Yazidiism.
But that's a place that, like, local people don't ever really go to. It's only really internationals who have some sort of interest in world religions that end up going there.
Sure. Or Yazidis.
Yeah.
So did you actually go into Lalish?
Mm-hmm.
Did you go into the temple
yep,
and all
we
of
we got
that?
A full tour.
Did you have to take your shoes off?
Uh-huh. It was cold that
yeah.
day. And we were able to ask a lot of questions, and the people were incredibly hospitable and, guided us through all of the inner areas where there's, like, vats of oil stored and, you know, little cubby holes with fire in them. There's a tomb down there that people throw scarves at over their shoulder to get wishes granted. And
yeah, maybe the next time I go to Iraq, I'll have to go up there.
Yeah.
because now that I know more, I really, really want to see it. The other place that I feel like many more people go to eagerly is El Coche.
Yeah.
Which we do reference in the Chaldean church episodes, because it's one of the seats of the Chaldean church.
Ancient, historical.
So there's kind of three parts to El Coche. There's the ancient monastery that's up on the hill.
So the Rabban Hormizd Monastery.
Mm-hmm. And there's a kind of a family that lives up there and maintains it mm-hmm. at this point. And that's really cool.
Yeah. Be careful. Go with a guide. You could get lost forever.
Yeah. There are deep, deep caves that go way, way, way back into the mountain.
And there's no light.
No light. That probably is one of the freakiest experiences I had, as we kind of blithely just wandered into one.
Oh, dear.
And got far enough back in there that, like, I was like, okay. At this point, I could find my way back out. If I go any further and we turn off in any direction, I'm not going to be able to find my way back. And so it was like, guys, I'm not going to go any farther. And I turned around and came back by myself. I was like, I'm walking through the dark with a flashlight. And if I get lost, like, this feels really dangerous to do this by myself. But I'm confident enough to know that I can get back. And I think they maybe had a guide at the front, or the guy who runs the place went in after them, because he brought them back out like a totally different, like, a totally different way.
Yeah.
Like,
I've been there multiple times, and, like, I still have no idea how to get around in there.
Yeah. The main monastery part is not maze-like. It's just if you get back into the caves, where they hid.
Or lived.
But the main monastery is really beautiful. It gets a lot of light. It's on top of the mountain. Mm-hmm. It's all whitewashed inside, so it seems even brighter. And there are scriptures carved into the walls in Aramaic, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really cool. It's a
beautiful script, too.
Mm-hmm. There are 7 curves in the road coming up to the monastery, and it's because the Chaldeans use it as the 7 stops on the walk of Christ.
I don't think I knew Easter. That.
You didn't know that? So, like, it's really common, and we had some Chaldean people with us when we went, for them to walk up the road and stop at each of the 7 signs of the cross. And pray.
Yeah.
Which is dedication, because that is a steep hill.
Like, it also needs those 7 switchbacks, uh-huh. because there's no way you're getting up it otherwise. Yeah.
And I think the people who decided to walk, I think it took them a good 2 hours. And I mean, they were stopping and praying.
Right.
But it took them a long time. We were all done being up there by the time they got there. And they were like, yeah, we're done too. So that's the main one, and that looks out over kind of the Nineveh Plain. It's really beautiful.
At the bottom of that hill, there's another monastery.
The new monastery.
The new monastery.
Also the same name, though.
Yeah. I think it's just the modern one, although, I mean, it's also a little old.
Yeah. And it has a big chapel.
Uh-huh. And that's where, like, monks live and work still.
And I think there's a boys' orphanage there, too. Also really beautiful. We accidentally stumbled into where the monk's private living space was and were told to get out very nicely.
Yeah.
But still, like, you cannot be in here. And we're like, really sorry. There are no signs. How are we going to know?
Yeah. Crazy woman running around in the men's monastery.
Yeah. But also very hospitable people. They had, I think, water and oranges for us when we came down off of the mountain, and gave us a place to sit and eat lunch together. And there's also a museum archive there with ancient texts, which if the right monk is around, you can get in and they'll show you some of them.
Oh, really?
We had bad timing, and the correct guy was not at the monastery at the time.
I'm not sure it even occurred to us to ask, because I think the correct guy probably was there. We met a guy who, and I'm sure I mentioned this when we talked before mm-hmm. about some of this, was the funnest, most interesting monk with his leather jacket and his black sunglasses and his, you know, black jeans, and doesn't look the way you think in your head.
The cool monk.
He was definitely the cool monk. And he was working on translating a lot of ancient texts into modern Arabic, actually, and putting them online so that the youth could have access to the ancient documents.
That's probably the guy.
Man,
you missed your chance.
I did. I didn't even know there was a chance.
If you go into the town that's next to Alkosh, is kind of the third part of Alkosh.
I mean, the town is Alkosh. Yes. The monastery is not Alkosh.
That's true. The town, not the monastery. There is an ancient synagogue, which is kind of mind-blowing to me. I was like, I did not even think about there being Jewish people.
But there were Jews who lived all over Iraq.
Yeah. And the synagogue is ancient, but it's also hasn't been that long since it's been in use. Mm-hmm. The story that we were told was that during World War II, the Jewish families that were living in Alkosh decided to go to Israel once the nation of Israel had been established, to kind of flee, I guess, and left the keys with their Muslim neighbors and asked them to take care of the synagogue while they were gone. So you can go into the synagogue now.
Provided you can find the family. Keys.
Which, if in our case, busload of white people kind of roll up to where the synagogue is, the neighbor comes out and he's like, you want to go in? And we're like, yeah. So in the synagogue is the tomb of
Nahum.
Yeah. Allegedly.
Yeah.
I think there is some debate.
I mean, there are some other places that claim to be the tomb of Nahum.
Yeah.
So there is only that debate. I don't think there's any debate about
that it is
that it's somebody else.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Like, there, it is the tomb of Nahum. Mm-hmm. His bones are not there anymore, though.
Right.
They have been taken, I mean, years ago, up to a Christian church, and they are in the wall crypt.
I can't say that word.
Reliquary?
That's the one.
I don't know, but like there's a plaque on the wall, and it, you know, says that this is where the bones of Nahum have been interred.
That's also, the tomb of Nahum is really cool because there's Hebrew mm-hmm. writings carved all over the walls.
And like, it's really interesting, too, because the style of, like, the architecture and the decor in there really is different. Mm-hmm. So all of the light fixtures, what's left of them, and the other decorative carvings on the walls have a very different feel mm-hmm. than anything else you run into in Iraq.
Yeah, yeah. It is really cool. That's also the only place we ran into fence.
Yeah.
They have the area where his tomb is kind of fenced off, so you can't actually, like, approach it directly. You can reach through and touch it, but you can't, like, get up by it or yeah. on it. And I think that's just the neighbor put it up so that people wouldn't bother it. Yeah. There's a second tomb in there. Did you know this?
No.
So there's a second tomb in the same
synagogue
area. Mm-hmm. It's outside in the okay. yard, kind of in a corner.
Okay.
And it's either Nahum's wife or Nahum's sister, whose name was Sarah.
Oh. Cool.
So they're both kind of equally cared for, which I thought was really neat.
We'd love to hear from you. You can find us at Servant Group International on Facebook or Instagram, and you should check out our blog and complete transcripts over at servantgroup.org.
And it's really helpful for us if you share our podcast or leave a review on whatever platform you listen to this podcast on. It helps us know that people are listening, and you can let us know what you want to hear next.
Thanks for listening.
Yeah, some things fall out of your brain.
They do.